listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and this evening's program is a follow-up to a program from earlier this month, September 2nd to be exact, wherein we listened to Michael Bach's performance of Cage's 1-8 for solo cello from 1991 from the beautiful premiere recording released by Mode Records in 2004. Tonight, we'll listen to John Cage's 1-8 as performed simultaneously with his 1-08, both composed in 1991, 1-8 not performed by Michael Bach again, and 1-08 performed by the Orchestra del Teatro La Fenice, conducted by Arturo Tamayo, more about that later, but by cellist Karen Crummell and the Chance Philharmonic. A CD of this performance was released on the Ogre Ogress label in 2010, the recording and mastering done by Glenn Freeman, founder of Ogre Ogress Productions, as well as percussionist in this recording, with artwork by Ladislav Hanka, liner notes by George Adams, and design by Heidi Stuckey. 1-08 was written for the largest ensemble of any of Cage's so-called number pieces, which refers to the series of works Cage was writing during the last several years of his life, using time bracket notation. All of Cage's number pieces bear number titles, denoting the number of players or parts called for in their realizations, a superscript number appearing after the primary number, for example, 1-8, indicating that it is the eighth work in the number pieces series that is written for a solo player. If 2 appears as a title without a superscript number, it would indicate that it is the first piece in the number series scored for 2 players, that is, it would not be written 2-1. 1-08 is scored for an orchestra of 108 players, and significantly can be paired not only with 1-8, but with Cage's 2-3, also dating from 1991, scored for show and conch shells. I say significantly because on this Ogre Ogress CD, we hear realizations of both of these possibilities. In the 2-3 and 1-08 coupling, Glenn Freeman performs on conch shells and Tamami Tono performs on the show. As we learned in our earlier program on the subject of the number pieces, 1-8 was written for and with Michael Bach, a German cellist, as well as the inventor of the Bach Bogen, a curved bow that allows players to play simultaneously upon all 4 strings of the cello. And as Adams informs in his liner notes, Cage's notation of the piece is precise, indicating which string and which player to play the note with, and that the performance instructions in regards to dynamics and lengths of notes remain vague, allowing for new and different realizations of the piece in each new performance. Several years after Cage's death, Merce Cunningham used 1-08 for orchestra combined with 1-8 for solo cello, the otherwise 2 distinct compositions when combined, changing the title to read 1-8 and 1-08, for his choreographed work entitled Interscape, which premiered at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. in 2000. When performed together, the effect is that of a cello concerto, with the cello parts to be played during the periods of silence built into the orchestral score. All the parts are written in Cage's time bracket notation, which serve to indicate an exact time frame within which freely placed single notes are to begin and end. The work is therefore both indeterminate and fixed. The overall form, order of events, and density is predetermined, but the actual instances of overlap are not. The orchestra's instrumentation is specified, but the percussion parts are left open, but should be distinguished from each other. All should be very resonant and played by bowing or by playing tremolos. Cage suggests using a variety of East Asian instruments, including Chinese and Turkish cymbals, Japanese temple gongs, thunder sheets, and Balinese gongs. I should note that an excerpt of the Cunningham Dance Company's performance of Cunningham's Interscape with Cage's 1-8 and 1-08 can be heard on the New World Records 10-CD compilation set entitled Music for Merce, 10 CDs representing the work of many of the musicians who had enjoyed sustained collaborative relationship with Cage and or Cunningham over the years. The musicians for the Cunningham performance featured Lauren Dempster, cello, and the Orchestra del Teatro La Fenice, conducted by Arturo Tamayo. It's interesting to note that Tamayo chose to conduct the orchestra in this performance, as Cage, when speaking about his number pieces, states emphatically that they are not to be conducted. Mark Swed, music critic for the Los Angeles Times, wrote at length on this topic in his Cage and Counting, The Number Pieces, an excellent article he contributed to the Metal Box catalog for Cage's Roly Holy Over a Circus, New York, Rizzoli, 1993, as follows. Until The Number Pieces, Cage had seldom worked with orchestras, and one of the few occasions that he had, the results were rarely happy. One of the more notorious incidents, but one that exemplifies the way orchestra players perceived Cage as a threat to their values, and how a mob psychology can take over even among distinguished artists, was the New York Philharmonic's infamous rebellion at its 1964 performance of Atlas Eclipticalis. The instrumental parts, which are derived from star charts, require a certain musical creativity from the players. Some, instead, reacted with sheer silliness that even Leonard Bernstein, the conductor, couldn't control. Not surprisingly, Cage concentrated most of his music on himself as performer and on a cadre of sympathetic, dedicated, and remarkable performers, the most famous of whom is the pianist David Tudor. With 101, the first of several number pieces for orchestra, Cage took a new tack in working with the classical symphonic ensemble. For it, Cage supplied an uncharacteristically long score note. Many of the number pieces have minimal instructions and require musicians to make decisions they are not at all accustomed to making, such as what instrument to play, what dynamic to use, how long to hold the note. Cage wrote, "Thoreau said, the best form of government is no government at all, and that is the form we'll have when we are ready for it." This piece assumes, right or wrongly, that we are ready for it. Though we don't have them, we need utilities. Good air, good homes, good food, good transportation, clothing, communication, etc., including intelligence. But we don't need government. The struggle for power between nations, the protection of the rich from the poor, the deprivation of the poor, and the demoralization of both the poor and the rich, the ruination of the environment by means of government's collaboration with the military and the corporate. Mark Swed continues, claiming that a performance of music can be a metaphor for society, Cage here does what he can to make anarchy work. There is no conductor and no full score, only individual parts with their flexible time brackets. The conductor serves to coach rehearsals, to make sure the players understand what they are offered to contribute to the ensemble. But for the performance, Cage allows the players to play without being commanded. They are not even required to synchronize the chronometers, as Cage said, as long as they start them neither immediately nor long after the tuning of the instruments. Yet for all the freedom granted, Cage does not relinquish his role as a creator, and he does have immediate sonic images in mind, which he describes vividly. The piccolo, double reed, and brass are asked to produce a quality of tone he calls ragged or imperfect, that is, not turned on or off as one does an electric light, but brushed into existence as in Oriental calligraphy, where the ink, the sound, is not always seen, or if so, is streaked with white, silence. The flutes and clarinets, on the other hand, are to play so very softly that a listener is not always certain he has heard them. The strings play with a loose bow that is rolled so that it produces a sound more like a frictional percussion sound than like a sustained tone, full of uncontrolled changes of frequency, tone quality, and silence. As Swed goes on, nothing in 101 is exactly coordinated, but unlike many of the number pieces, it has an apparent if nebulous shape. It bursts forth with a raw blast of high, loud wind and brass sound, and another blast occurs approximately between 9 minutes and 10 minutes 15 seconds from the inexact beginning. Other groups of instruments play music of different character, and there are fabulous percussion events that include shimmering bowed piano strings, the deeply satisfying richness of a contrabass marimba, and the exotic jungle sound of the bull roarer. With such utopian orchestral experiments as 101 and other number piece orchestral works, the largest being 108, as well as in many of the smaller ensemble pieces, Cage was ultimately taking a new look at his old nemesis, harmony. In Cage's metaphor of the orchestra as society, harmony is the government. The challenge in 101 is for the music to be together, while the individual parts remain themselves. This has been troubling to the few major American orchestras that have attempted these works. Orchestra musicians are often among the most disenfranchised of all musicians, spending their lives submerging their own musical personalities into the will of a conductor. And it is not an uncommon response to the situation for the more frustrated to become reactionary in self-defense. Moreover, it is the rare, unegotistical conductor who is satisfied with a behind-the-scenes role while his orchestra is on stage. Boston Symphony Orchestra music director Seiji Ozawa allotted minimal rehearsal time for the premiere of 101, perhaps because he had no functional role in the actual public performance. But from that experience, Cage learned to make the orchestra pieces less and less complicated to play, so much so that they would need little rehearsal once the rules were understood. This, in turn, had the additional benefit of offering the players themselves an opportunity for discovery during the performance, so that they too can share with the audience in the freshness of listening to music. In a later piece, 74, written in 1992 for the American Composers Orchestra, or ACO, the American orchestra with the greatest experience in playing contemporary music of a wide variety, Cage kept the parts especially simple. Each player has a short series of single notes in flexible time brackets. The composition consists of two such series of tones, half of the orchestra given an upper series, the other half the lower, and each series becomes what Cage called a unison of differences. Though the same pitches are played, the notes all have their own lengths and further their own amplitudes, he wrote in the score note. They come from the same or different instruments. When they come from the same instrument, for example, the violins, they may have different overtone structures, i.e., they may be bowed differently, etc. This again goes against every instinct of the orchestra player, who has long been drilled not to play individually, but to be uncommonly attuned to making the sound of the whole homogeneous. Indeed, the world's greatest orchestras, and especially the European ones like the Vienna Philharmonic, the Berlin Philharmonic, and the Concertgebouw, are considered great precisely because of the degree to which the players convey a single musical style. But in 74, Cage even suggests that not only the usual imperceptions of tuning be accepted, but that players might actually exaggerate them slightly so that the music would be microtonal. Vibrato, differences of breathing, and special use of the lips can be present or absent. All these differences are to be expressed by each musician individually, not as the result of plans made with others. The result is two unison series superimposed, each series having its own 14 pitches and its own time brackets. This is, however, in no sense a question of counterpoint, Cage notes. And of course, it isn't anything resembling that rigid discipline that Cage studied, along with harmony, in Schoenberg's classes. Instead, the piece proves to sound highly unpredictable, and the unisons, with their timbral, their durational, and their subtle intonational differences, as well as their blurred differences of timing due to the flexibility of the time brackets, become a kind of chord. One has the sense in listening that a great harmonic machine is in operation, in that everyone has the same purpose and an audible feeling of togetherness, but each sound is still allowed a certain freedom of musical speech. Just as Cage subsumes counterpoint into harmony in 74, he does the same with melody in 7-2. This is a hauntingly beautiful piece, lasting nearly an hour, written for very low-pitched woodwind and brass instruments and percussion instruments that are not named, but should be very resonant and played in such a way that attacks are not noticeable. In the score note, Cage writes, "Let the piece become a melody, which moves from percussion 2 to bass clarinet, to bass flute, to contrabass, to violoncello, to percussion 1, to bass trombone, a melody in an anarchic society of sounds." The piece, with its womb-like, soft, long, deep, resonant, breathy sounds, hardly sounds like a melody. The instrumental progression happens almost too imperceptibly to be followed, whereas melody implies some sort of distinct, discernible shape. In 7-2, the shape is more likely sensed than heard, and it seems not unlike the progression of sounds in other number pieces. What holds the piece together instead is the sonority. Sounds are linked by their commonality, a commonality that produces a sense of harmony. In Cage's number pieces, such divisions between harmony and counterpoint, or between harmony and melody, are not unlike the phenomenon of the wave-particle duality in physics. An electron acts like a wave in some circumstances, a particle in others. But it is, in actuality, neither. It is something that cannot be envisioned or described. It is a way of being with various manifestations. Because of the uncertainty principle, you can't actually pinpoint an electron, so we picture it as a cloud or a wave, but we think of it as an individual. Like the electron, each sound for Cage is itself a distinct point, yet it can be indistinguishable as part of something greater. The harmony of the number pieces is like that. Cage says in the note to 103 that he still wants, as he had wanted in all his chance compositions, the sounds to be free of my intentions, so that they are just sounds themselves, that is. And he suggests that to bring this about, the musicians, while they are playing, should be attentive to what they are doing, listening, that is, to each sound he or she makes, how it begins, continues, and ends. This is both something new and old in Cage. What always characterized Cage's music, from the boisterous percussion pieces of his youth with which he announced himself to the world, to these final, quiet, and reflective number pieces, is the realization that such musical sound could be a non-hierarchic continuum from noise to silence, whether the sounds were intentional or unintentional, structured or unstructured, acoustic or electronic, live or recorded. As inclusionary as this new music was, however, the one thing it had to give up was harmonic glue and directionality. With the number pieces, Cage created a non-directional, unsticky harmony. While the excerpt included on the Music from Earth CD is 14 minutes and 26 seconds, in any full-length performance, 108 and 108 run roughly 45 minutes in length. Let's listen now to 1-8 and 108 in its entirety from the Ogre Ogress CD featuring Karen Crummell, cellist, and the Chance Philharmonic. Enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.